On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When science and politics collide, the truth becomes hostage in a hurry to all kinds of shenanigans. Last week, as snowflake babies swirled and President Bush prepared to veto expanded federal funding of embryonic stem cell research, the president's top political advisor, Karl Rove, sat down with the Denver Post to give a shaky science lesson. Researchers claimed Rove have found far more promise from adult stem cells than from embryonic stem cells. Wrong, said a chorus of scientists in reply. This hour, we're going to push past the politics and philosophical debate to look straight at the facts on stem cell research and where it really stands, the giant promise and the pitfalls. Up next on Point, just the facts on stem cells and the cures they may hold. In a moment, we'll sit down with two scientists who will tell us in plain English what's going on the stem cell research front. But first, we turn to the wider world beyond the American debate. Brian Walsh of Time magazine has just been to Singapore, where they're pouring billions into biological and stem cell research and attracting top American talent to help. He joins us from Hong Kong. Brian, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much.
So Singapore's got something called the Biopolis. What is it? What are they up to?
The Biopolis is it's a government initiative, and it's a set of buildings, really, that began in about 2002. And it's the government's sort of a concrete extension of the government's decision to go big into bioscience. It's a group of seven buildings that are interconnected. They share resources. They have the top line equipment, and they're working together to not just stem cells, but to a range of life science material.
And billions of dollars to back up that effort, and an outreach program that goes right around the world to find talent. Where are they looking?
They're looking anywhere they can. They're looking in the UK. They're looking in the United States, looking in Canada. They're also looking in Asia. And obviously stem cells has been a big pull for them because stem cell research in Singapore, basically everything the only thing that's against the law in Singapore is reproductive cloning. Otherwise, it's very open. The government's very willing to fund that. And there's no risk in Singapore that, you know, 2 years from now the government's going to change and they'll change their mind on this. They're committed. And you know, as a scientist, you can go there and do the work that you want.
So when they go around the world looking for talent to join this effort, what's their message? How do they attract people?
Their message is, come to Singapore. You can do the science you want. We'll give you all the equipment you need. The funding is very open. The funding is very easy to get, I think, especially compared to what's going on in the U.S. The ethical regulations are strong, but they're fair. And you don't have to worry about politics getting in the way of your work.
You quote one of the top guys there calling himself a people snatcher. He says,
right.
I go to the U.S. and I tell those scientists, come to Singapore and finish your work. Is he having success? Are scientists responding to the siren song there?
Definitely, indeed. I mean, just recently, there's two scientists who came from the U.S. They'll be coming to Singapore soon, Nancy Jenkins and Neil Copeland. They're both involved in stem cell research, and they were recruited quite heavily by Stanford, which is trying to do its own stem cell work. But in the end, they chose Singapore because they just weren't confident that the funding and the rules would be there. They knew it would be there in Singapore.
And what about across the rest of Asia, Brian? Is stem cell research something that's being eyed and worked on in other Asian nations as well? Are they putting restrictions on that research?
Certainly. We know South Korea was big into stem cell research with Dr. Hwang Woo-suk, who supposedly was the first person to come up with therapeutic cloning. That obviously turned out not to be true in the end, but they are quite big into this, and they have a lot of talent. China, it's not quite clear what's going on in China, honestly. But we know that the rules there are very open. There are a lot of very smart people working there, and the government is perfectly willing to let that go ahead. I mean, there may be many embryonic stem cell lines that have been derived by scientists there, and I think people assume that down the line we're going to see a lot of really amazing stuff coming out of there.
You quote a top British scientist who was lured to Singapore calling it a scientific heaven. What about the competitive issue here? Is it a foregone conclusion that, I don't know, one continent or another will lead in stem cells, North America or Asia or Europe?
I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I mean, it's interesting. Talking to these guys, sure, they had moved maybe from Scotland or Britain or the U.S. to come to Singapore. But their point was that, you know, it's not brain drain may actually be the wrong way to look at it. Really, it's a brain circulation. If you're a scientist and you have talent, you can go almost anywhere in the world if they'll support your research. And more countries around the world have the capacity and the desire to do that. It's almost like a football team or like America, you know, soccer,
right,
actually,
right,
where you can be hired and you'll go and it's fine. And then maybe you'll come back. Maybe you'll go somewhere else.
But for now, what you've seen is this Biopolis attracting great talent right there to Little Singapore and them forging ahead, no holds barred. Excitement in Singapore about this effort? Are they expecting great things?
They're expecting great things. I mean, they're not doing this so much for national glory. The Singaporeans are extremely pragmatic. Philip Yeo, who's sort of heading this up, he's the people snatcher.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, what we want, we're in this for the economics. We want to come up with drugs. We want to come up with clinical treatments that we can then sell. They also want to create a positive science environment that allows to raise the level of their students, actually. They want to create a skilled workforce that can attract drug companies to bring jobs to Singapore as well, high-value jobs that won't leave to go to China, for instance.
So very practical, and off they go. Brian Walsh, thanks for your reporting from Singapore, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Brian Walsh, staff writer for Time Magazine. He joined us from Hong Kong. We are looking today at the facts behind the fury in the U.S. over stem cell research, asking where that research really stands. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. We've got two great researchers with us today, one who focuses on adult stem cell research and one on embryonic. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Amy Wagers. She's a principal investigator in stem cell research at the Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston. Amy Wagers, thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And with us from San Francisco, Dr. Arnold Kriegstein. He's director of the Institute for Regeneration Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Kriegstein, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tom.
So I guess I just want to get a kind of a reading from each of you as we begin. Amy Wagers, maybe first to you. You must have watched very closely in this last few weeks as the debate took place in Washington. Do you think that we've got a well-informed debate about what's going on in stem cell research?
I think we have an extremely well-informed public, and I'm always impressed by the level of understanding that the average person that I talk to has about stem cells. And I think it's wonderful that we're having this kind of debate in this country. And I was very happy to see the discussion of the various different types of research that are going on.
Arnold Kriegstein, there have been a lot of claims made about this or that, what's advantageous, what's not. I want to listen with you, if I may, for a moment to Senator Sam Brownback, Republican of Kansas. This is a press conference last week where he argued that adult stem cell research is not only the moral way to go because it involved using no embryos, but was scientifically the more promising avenue for research.
We have spent $500 million, nearly half a billion dollars over the last 5 years funding embryonic stem cell research in animals and humans, and we have zero human clinical applications or human applications at all. If we had used that half a billion dollars the last 5 years to fund adult stem cell research, cord blood research, we would have many more treatments. We would have more people probably alive today.
Arnold Kriegstein in San Francisco, you focus on embryonic, not only, but a focus on embryonic stem cell research. Amy Wagers focuses on adult. What about Sam Brownback, Senator Brownback's statement there? Have we misplaced our resources? And Karl Rove saying adult stem cells are really the more promising path. Is that true?
Well, actually, I think Senator Brownback misstated the facts in that quote that you just aired. Mm. For example, the notion that after 5 years of research in animal as well as human embryonic stem cells, no human diseases have been cured. Well, that certainly is true. But in animal models, a whole range of diseases have been treated, if not cured, using various derivatives of embryonic stem cells in animals. And it's true that in human embryonic stem cell research, there isn't yet evidence of a human treatment for a disease. But you have to keep in perspective the fact that human embryonic stem cells were first derived only in 1998. There really hasn't been very much time, first of all, for these studies to actually progress to the point where there's a therapy or a treatment for a disease. And secondly, because of the restrictions that have been imposed for the last 5 years on NIH funding for work with human embryonic stem cells, that's really slowed down progress in this area to begin with, so that the notion that there hasn't been as much progress with embryonic stem cells as there has been with adult stem cells has to be seen in the context of how much research and work in both animal and human lines can be pursued right now in labs all over the country involving adult cells, while the embryonic stem cell efforts have really been quite hampered.
Dr. Wagers, adult stem cells are your focus. Are you focused on them for moral reasons because you think the bigger payoff is going to be there? Is that just your specialty? Do you look at embryonic stem cells as equally promising or second class in their promise?
I definitely see embryonic stem cells as equally promising. The reasons that I'm in adult stem cell research are really somewhat historical and personal to me. I got into studying blood-forming or hematopoietic stem cells as an interest in graduate school when I matched with a patient for a bone marrow transplant and became interested in hematopoietic stem cell biology. At the time, was looking for moving to the next laboratory that I would do research in. And through understanding and investigating processes of bone marrow transplant, started studying hematopoietic stem cells.
So when Karl Rove says adult stem cells have far more promise than embryonic, agree, disagree?
I disagree with that. I think both are equally promising, and in many cases it's impossible to predict which one will bring us closer quicker to finding treatments and cures. And I think another important point is that studying embryonic and adult stem cells is really a synergistic research effort.
Dr. Kriegstein, I know that people working in your lab work on embryonic, some work on adult. Could you explain just in simple terms the difference between the two, how they're acquired or harvested, and the difference in promise, if there is a clear difference in promise or approach between the two?
Sure. Embryonic stem cells, especially human embryonic stem cells, refer to the cells of a little cluster of undifferentiated or unspecialized cells that appear after 3 to 4 days of after fertilization of human embryo development in a stage known as a blastocyst. And the entire embryo at that age is smaller than the dot at the end of a sentence. In fact, most people couldn't see this without a microscope. And the number of cells we're talking about are maybe 150 or so, and they look reasonably similar to each other. They're just undifferentiated, unspecialized cells. There are no organs. There's no nervous system, no blood or bone or muscle. And these cells can then be cultured in a dish in a laboratory and turned into what's known as a stem cell line. And one of the features of these stem cells is that they can self-renew, so they can divide and renew themselves every time they divide rather than turn into a different cell type, which is what normally happens in development in the embryo. And so you can expand the number of stem cells indefinitely. In fact, you can create essentially unlimited numbers of these stem cells. And each of those cells has the property known as pluripotentiality. It has the ability to turn into any of the tissues found in the adult body: nerve, muscle, bone, blood, and so forth. And the trick is getting it to do that, but it provides an unlimited source of raw material to replace injured or diseased tissue or to help repair or regenerate injured tissue. And as a resource, a cell-based therapeutic resource, the human embryonic stem cells offer a unlimited number of cells that can be generated with a certain degree of quality control and purity, guaranteed, for example, to be free of viruses and so forth. So it potentially can offer a terrific source of what's known as cell-based therapies.
What's the current thinking about the range of afflictions or diseases that those therapies might one day be able to treat?
Well, the list is quite long, and it actually seems to be growing almost daily. It turns out that, as you might imagine, any organ in the body arises originally from a stem cell origin. And in many of these adult tissues, for example, in the brain, there turn out to be residual or resident stem cells that can still generate new neurons during later life. And similarly, there are stem cells that are found in muscle and skin and liver and other organs. These are known as adult stem cells. They have less potential than the embryonic stem cells. They've been limited to usually just the organs in which they reside. So a nerve stem cell might replace nerve tissue, but it wouldn't generate muscle or liver tissue, and vice versa. So those adult stem cells have a little more restricted potential than the embryonic ones do. And generally, they don't also have the ability to expand indefinitely. So at least in a laboratory, you can expand their numbers significantly, but there seems to be a limit to how far that can go. So those currently are some of the differences between the adult and the embryonic stem cells.
Amy Wagers, we're hearing expectations or hopes from embryonic stem cells eventually, maybe of treatments for diabetes, spinal cord injury, Parkinson's disease, a lot else. Some say that the adult stem cell therapies may come sooner, though their ultimate potential may be more restricted. How do you see it?
I think it's difficult to predict exact timelines for these things. And again, I would go back to my previous point that each type of research informs the other. And certainly we'll learn a lot from studying adult stem cells and using those cells in cell therapy that will help us to design better strategies for using embryonic cells and their derivatives in similar types of transplantation strategies or in laboratory experiments to identify new compounds that help us to direct the differentiation or specialization of those cells.
Do you agree with Dr. Kriegstein that ultimately embryonic stem cells have more potential to treat more problems?
It's certainly true that it's unclear that every tissue in the body will have an adult stem cell that's capable of regenerating it. And it's also true that embryonic stem cells clearly show potential to make any cell in the body. So in that sense, embryonic cells are applicable to a wide range of tissue diseases that adult stem cells may not be available for.
Just to get it on the table, Dr. Kriegstein, your lab does, and you do a lot of work with animal embryonic stem cells, but also human. How do you look at the moral question here?
Well, I mean, obviously that's a difficult issue in the sense that people have different opinions about using human embryonic stem cells and how they're derived. My own feeling is that a blastocyst embryo is not a person. It certainly is a potential person, but at the stage that we're describing, a blastocyst that hasn't reached the stage of normal development, for instance, when it would be implanted into the womb, and in fact, most of the embryos, in fact, all of the embryos that we've used so far to derive stem cell lines would otherwise have been destroyed. I find that if it's morally acceptable to destroy embryos at that stage, I don't see why it wouldn't be morally acceptable to use them to derive stem cell lines to investigate the potential to use them for treating or helping to cure human disease.
When President Bush had the so-called snowflake babies who had come from some of these embryos with him at the veto, I guess, ceremony, Senator Arlen Specter was later quoted saying, you know, maybe 128 of these babies have been born, and 400,000 or so rejected embryos are in deep freezes and headed to be thrown out. You're saying, let's not throw them out, let's use them.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Amy Wager, you're focused on adult stem cells. Is there a moral component to that focus, or is it just the path your research happened to take? How do you look at embryonic? Would you do it, or do you feel some moral qualms about it?
Certainly, my focus in my laboratory derives from my scientific history, and I interact on a daily basis with other researchers who are pursuing embryonic stem cell research, and the work that I do is informed by the discoveries that they make, and I benefit a lot from that science and those interactions.
But you don't do it yourself, moral qualm or not?
No, not because of any moral qualm regarding embryonic stem cell research.
I want to listen to another clip, if we may. This is from Senator Rick Santorum, Republican of Pennsylvania. He put forward an alternate bill last week that would support only adult stem cell research. On the Senate floor, he speculated that embryonic stem cell research would lead further and further down a moral sinkhole, perhaps one day growing fetuses in special farms to harvest tissues from older and older embryos.
If you wait till they're a month or 2 months old, now you've got the right time to be able to harvest these tissues for, name it. I think that's, I won't say highly likely, I'm not a scientist, I don't know. I don't think that's without a question. And then what will we be saying? Well, if we can just maybe put these embryos in artificial wombs for a while, let them develop for a little bit, maybe have to implant them into a woman who volunteers. No moral objection here. She volunteered.
Dr. Kriegstein, a laboratory perspective on this. First of all, just factually, the senator is describing kind of farms of older embryos. I don't know, maybe one day full human beings that we would harvest for their parts. Is that to you a logical path? You suggest that's a kind of logical path or almost inevitable that this research goes down. As a scientist, what's your response?
I don't think any responsible scientist would have any scenario remotely resembling the one you've just heard about in mind. In fact, any institution, especially, for example, ours, which has an active human embryonic stem cell effort, has an ethics committee that has to, in addition to the scientific review that any proposal that involves these kinds of cells would have to go through, there's an ethics review committee. And this committee consists of professional ethicists and lawyers and scientists and even lay members of the public who are concerned. There's a high school biology teacher on our committee. And they review very carefully what the potential benefits of a proposed study would be, also what the ethical issues might be, very carefully examining all these aspects. And in fact, any work involving human embryos or the derivation of tissues related to human embryos or oocytes and the donation or obtaining this sort of biological material, all of that needs to go through this level of ethical review at our institution and also at all the other institutions in this country that use human embryonic stem cells.
Let me ask you this is going to go on around the world, and some places may have no ethical compunction for all we know. So I mean, and already we harvest organs from cadavers. We sometimes have living people who might give a kidney to a loved one to help them. I mean, so it's, we have some experience with this. If you put the ethics issue aside, and we understand fully that you do not, but if you did, is Senator Santorum correct in suggesting that there would be, ethics aside, is there an advantage to older embryos in terms of developing therapies?
Well, in a way, it's ironic that it's currently permitted to use NIH funds, for example, on tissue that's harvested from aborted fetuses. And in fact, some stem cells are obtained that way, and some of them are actually headed for clinical trials. So that seems to be morally acceptable, but to use blastocyst embryos in the way that we've described to derive stem cell lines right now is considered not to be acceptable right now.
But that suggests there could be a temptation that those older embryos do have potential therapies that would catch a scientist's eye, ethics aside.
Well, as you'd heard already, that there are stem cells resident in certain tissues of the body throughout development, in early embryonic stages, also in the adult. And so they could be harvested at any of a number of these different stages. But there again, I think scientists have to face some ethical decisions about whether they want to actually harvest stem cells at those different stages. I think most responsible scientists would not do that.
So you can't get away from the ethics issue, and you say don't want to. I want to turn to our listeners, if I may. Stephen's calling from Baltimore. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just want to say that I agree with both doctors, and especially Dr. Wagers, in saying that the link exists between adult and embryonic stem cells. I just want to make a quick comment. A few years ago, I suffered a fairly traumatic injury to my cornea, and it was due to a procedure developed out at UC Berkeley by Dr. Roy Chuck that they were able to transplant what's called limbal stem cells from a cadaverous donor into my eye. And since that therapy, I've been able to accept a conventional cornea transplant and now have a functional level of vision. And I think it's ridiculous to stymie the progress of, you know, potential health benefits by pleasing the polls, and I think that that's really the only thing that those senators are saying. I think that to claim that they're doing it on a moral basis is just putting up a front for the conservative base.
So, well, I mean, people do have ethical concerns here, but you got your vision back. I mean, you avoided blindness by this.
Yeah, I was completely blind almost.
That's a pretty great payoff, and thanks very much, Stephen, for calling. Amy Wagers, speak to us for a moment in the adult stem cell path, or right across the lines, if you would, about how close we are to new therapies. I mean, here Stephen's saying he's already been treated. What's coming out of the pipeline? What's coming next?
Right. So there are sort of two categories of treatments that you can think about that derive from stem cell therapies, either adult or embryonic. That's cell therapy, which Dr. Kriegstein already talked about a bit, which would involve the transplantation of cells derived from stem cells or stem cells themselves into a patient to rebuild an organ. The other is using these cells as a model to understand disease and to develop new drugs that will treat that disease. And so by being able to isolate stem cells and study them in the laboratory, we can screen for new compounds that affect their function.
Are adult and embryonic equally valuable in that process? Do you need them both?
They are equally valuable. They teach us different lessons about different stages of the formation of tissues. Often embryonic stem cells and their development will teach us how a tissue is founded, and the isolation of adult stem cells from that tissue teaches us how it's repaired.
Where do you think therapies may be coming first? What's most promising?
I think that, again, they develop in parallel, and there's...
But I don't mean between the two, but just in toto. What's coming? I mean, we hear about all these great possibilities, mm-hmm. but it's mm-hmm. always a little bit vague. Mm-hmm. What's your sense of where we may have, therapies soon?
Right. So I mean, we do already have stem cell-based therapies. I mean, Stephen talked about one of them. Bone marrow transplant is a wonderful example of a successful stem cell therapy, which relies on blood-forming stem cells. And I think it's informative to realize that it took decades to get bone marrow transplants to a relatively common practice. Mm-hmm. And there are still hundreds of labs around the world that are studying bone marrow transplant and trying to make it more efficient and more effective. Mm-hmm. And so this is a continually evolving process.
Dr. Kriegstein, where are you looking first for new therapies to emerge?
Well, I just want to broaden the scope of stem cell biology for a moment and just point out that as a result of studying basic processes of stem cell biology, it's become more and more evident that many cancers, especially some of the most aggressive metastatic cancers, are actually due to cancer stem cells rather than adult cells that suddenly start becoming cancerous. It turns out that some of these resident adult stem cells that we've talked about seem to be the actual root cause of certain kinds of cancers. And this represents a real revolution in our understanding of those tumors, and it also represents a new opportunity because these stem cells have yet to be identified in most cases. But once they are, when markers are available to tell us just what those cells are, which ones in the tumor are the stem cells, there's the potential of developing new therapeutic targets. And that may lead to the treatment of these cancers with more conventional drug therapy, not cell-based therapies. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, these cancers may eventually be treated with the kind of approaches that actually will destroy those stem cells. In fact, this is true for certain kinds of cancers today, which even when metastatic can be actually eradicated only in those rare examples where we can actually target the stem cells themselves.
So cancer is a big target. Where else are you looking, Doctor, for early results, if you could look into your crystal ball with us?
Well, it's very difficult to make predictions in any field, especially in a field as challenging as this one. I think the idea of regenerating organs, of actual tissue replacement for an organ system, is going to be very, very challenging and difficult. It involves not only replacing the tissue, but usually blood vessel supply and just a whole range of very complicated processes. There are some diseases where a single cell type is at fault, and, for example, in type 1 diabetes, the islet cell that secretes insulin is the cell that is targeted by that illness.
Brenda's calling from Little River, South Carolina. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Brenda?
Okay, I'm a first-time caller, and I just want to say, Congress, they always get on and they have their own press conferences, so I don't understand why the medical community, when they make these statements that they know are not true, don't get on TV and make their own press conference just to inform the public and let them know, that these things are not true. Because America used to be at the forefront of medical research and innovation, and I think we're losing our edge. And, this research is going to go on with or without us. So we could either set the standard or we could let other countries set the standard.
Brenda, we've got it loud and clear. Let me put it to my panel. Dr. Kriegstein, how do you respond to that? Are scientists stepping up and speaking enough about what's going on here? And what about the American edge in bioscience here?
Well, I think most scientists aren't really political animals. They don't usually speak up. They rather prefer to be in their laboratories and get on with their work. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the issue. But I think that education is an important part of what most of us need to do as scientists, especially in this arena where there's so much public misconception and so much anxiety about what might be going on. And so I think that forums like this and opportunities that we have to actually educate the public or start a dialogue and let people participate or at least engage in some of the science that's going on is really the best way to overcome these kinds of misconceptions.
The White House put out a statement last week called Setting the Record Straight, saying that federally funded embryonic stem cell lines are widely available to scientists, essentially saying we don't have a problem here. Do you agree, Dr. Kriegstein?
Well, I disagree with that. As you may know, the number of lines that are available through federal-funded research amounts to around 20 or 22 of these lines, and they've all been created prior to 2001. And at UCSF, for example, we have created two of the lines that are on that approved list. But the technology has advanced, and the newer lines that have been created since that time, which you can't use federal funds to study, are actually in many ways better. They're not grown on animal cells, which the old cell lines were. The old lines have accumulated genetic defects that make them, most of them, genetically abnormal, while the newer lines are genetically normal. There's just a whole series of advantages to having new lines, and part of the other problem is that the limitation of using just a handful of lines is turning out to be more and more important, because these lines turn out not all to be equivalent. It's easier for some of them to turn into heart cells, others more easily turn into nerve cells, and we don't understand what creates that kind of variability. And in order to study these processes better, we actually need a larger number, a diverse number of stem cell lines.
Dr. Wagers, do you assume as a researcher that adult and embryonic stem cell research will go ahead globally whether the United States federal government funds it or not? And what about this issue of the American edge in this world? Do you see it at risk?
So it's clear that this research is ongoing, and that has happened over the last several years when there has been restricted federal funding for lines derived.
Globally.
It's going on globally. It's also going on in the U.S. through private donors who mm-hmm. really strongly believe in this research. It's certainly proceeding more slowly because of the restrictions that are imposed, and these are barriers to collaboration between laboratories that are funded federally or not. And so I think it's important to, or we will advance more quickly, and that's obviously very important to a large number of patients that are suffering from various diseases that can be treated with stem cell research.
And Dr. Kriegstein, what about the American edge in bioscience? Do you see it at risk here, or is that alarmist?
Well, I think the public, and especially your listeners, should know that the vast majority of advances that have been taking place recently in stem cell research are really not in the human embryonic stem cell arena, but rather very basic studies of stem cell biology, most of which is carried on in animal systems, including mice mostly, but also invertebrates and worms and zebrafish and so forth. That's all funded and fundable by the NIH. So there really has been an enormous foundation, essentially, for stem cell biology that's been created with the help of the NIH.
So the federal constraints are no problem, or Amy Wager says she thinks they are?
Well, they're certainly no problem for the animal work, and I think that's extremely important. But the human embryonic stem cell part of it is also critically important, because if any of the advances that are made in animal studies are going to be translated into patient therapies, that's going to have to involve human cells. And the sooner we can get those human cells into the hands of investigators, I think, the sooner the day will come when we'll be able to use them for therapies. So I fully agree with what Dr. Wagers just said. I think this is really, the policy in the federal level has really slowed down progress in this field and has kept many investigators from getting involved in work with human cells.
Let me take a call from Michael in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have a two-point question. One is, when you talk about, I'm a type 1 diabetic from the Joslin mm-hmm. Clinic, and mm-hmm. when you talk about transplanting the islets into the diabetic patient, what is the prevalence of the immune system redestroying that transplant, if you will, so that maybe the transplant won't take hold or won't last more than 6 months? There was a great deal of talk with the Alberta protocol, I guess, from Canada. And my other point was, the doctor from San Francisco mentioned that embryonic stem cells are not a human person, I believe is what he said, which I agree. They don't have constitutional rights. But can we agree that it is a human life form? I mean, it can't be a gerbil or anything else.
We'll take them both up. First, to the specific on diabetes, Dr. Wagers. I'm not sure I follow. You and Michael are deeper in this than we are. But what's the edge of research as pertains to diabetes there that he's speaking to?
Right. So Michael brings up a very important point, which is that the reason for the destruction of insulin-producing beta cells, which are the cells in the pancreas that are lost in type 1 diabetics, mm-hmm. is the attack of the body's own immune cells mm-hmm. on those beta cells. And so any approach to replacing those cells does have to take into account that those self-reactive cells will still be present in the patient. Mm-hmm. And there needs and there is parallel research at the Joslin and at other institutions trying to understand the immunology of diabetes and to divert the immune system away from attacking those replacement cells. But it's a very important problem. And I think it highlights the way that stem cell biology really has to dovetail with studies in other fields.
Does stem cell biology get us around that problem eventually?
There are studies in hematopoietic stem cells understanding the development of immune cells that may aid in understanding how those autoimmune processes happen. And so, as I said, this is a complex disease with multiple facets that contribute to it. And it's a two-part problem, really, in diabetes in that you have to replace the lost cells as well as reverse or halt the process that destroyed them in the first place.
And Dr. Kriegstein, the moral question or the definition question comes back. If it's not a human being, is it indeed human life? How do you look at that? And is that the way you frame it when you think about your research?
Well, yes, of course, these are living cells, and certainly a human embryo, I think, would be, by anyone's definition, human life. I think the real question is making a decision or a choice whether, in fact, these embryos that we all consider that we have committed already to be created in IVF clinics for part of a process of actually creating babies, that these leftover embryos, the ones that have been created and frozen away and that are, as we'd mentioned earlier, targeted for destruction, whether morally it's acceptable to just destroy those embryos or whether it would also be morally acceptable to use them in the kind of research that we've been discussing this morning. I think that's really the decision.
Let me take a call from Caroline in Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Caroline. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question. I think maybe I'll direct it at Amy
mm-hmm.
from the Joslin Center, right?
Great. What's your question?
It is. I have juvenile diabetes. I'm 33.
Okay.
And I had a baby last year, and I banked her blood.
This is from the which blood exactly?
I banked her cord blood. It's just a very common thing people do now with
Okay.
you have a baby, the cells can be taken from the
umbilical cord. Okay,
yes,
right.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting my call to come through. and I guess my question is it worth it? It's expensive to store these cells. Is it worth it to be doing that? Because of my concern is the possibility of my baby someday developing juvenile diabetes.
What we hear your baby. What's his or her name?
Her name's Lauren.
That's wonderful. Amy Wager, Caroline has saved some of Lauren's umbilical cord blood for exactly this potential kind of interest and purpose one day. Is it worth it, she asks.
Yeah, this is a question that I've been asked several times. It is a very expensive process to continue to maintain cord blood. The stem cells that are in cord blood really have shown potential for replacement of blood cells. I know there has been some suggestion that potentially there may be present in the cord blood other cells that might replace non-blood cells like the beta cells that are lost in the islets. But that research is really not well developed at this point.
So what's your advice today? She has diabetes. She's looking at her baby wondering, should
right.
I keep paying the
should
storage
I keep paying
bill?
This money? I mean, this is a very personal decision. That I can't say at this, based on the evidence that we have right now, that there is certainly going to be an application for those cells in treating juvenile diabetes. I can't say that there isn't. It's if it's possible to save them, I imagine it's useful, but I can't really give you a clear, definitive answer on that. I'm sorry.
Here we are in the world of research, Caroline. Yeah. There's an ambiguity, I guess, you and other parents are going to have to deal with. Dr. Kriegstein, if I may put a personal question, my mom has Parkinson's disease, a great and noble lady, but it's been rough. What about, many people do have that. What about on the Parkinson's front? What's the prospect?
Well, in Parkinson's disease, there's a proof of concept that transferring fetal stem cells, fetal mesencephalic cells, rather, into the brain, rather, of adult patients who have Parkinson's disease may be able to help the disease. And this has prompted an enormous effort around the world to derive these kinds of cells, the cells that are injured in Parkinson's disease, which are a kind of nerve cell that secretes this transmitter known as dopamine, to make these dopamine-secreting nerve cells out of either fetal or embryonic stem cells. And that effort has met with mixed success. No one yet has come up with a proper way of taking embryonic stem cells and making them just these kinds of dopaminergic neurons. But that's the hope, and the hope would be that once that's been achieved, that those cells could be then transplanted into the patients who have Parkinson's disease, and they may integrate and take over the function of the cells that have been lost.
Is that a hope that's years away, decades, or still, you know, very uncertain in its likelihood? How do you see it?
A little bit of all those things. I think it's very difficult to make these kinds of predictions on a timetable. Science, unfortunately, doesn't always progress in a very measured, linear way. It sometimes goes in fits and starts and sometimes takes some unexpected directions, and it really is difficult to say. But there is, as I say, is a worldwide effort now targeted toward creating these kinds of dopaminergic neurons out of stem cell precursors.
Mm. I want to thank both of you for spending some time with us today from the lab bench. It's great to get beyond some of the shouting and hear what's really going on. We know there are strong feelings here, but it's good to know the facts on what's emerging and where the promise stands. Dr. Arnold Kriegstein at the Institute for Regeneration Medicine, University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Kriegstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And Dr. Amy Wagers, Principal Investigator in Stem Cell Research at the Joslin Diabetes Center. Dr. Wagers, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I want to turn now, if I may, for a moment to Gareth Cook. He's a science writer at the Boston Globe, winner of the 2005 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for his coverage of stem cell research. Gareth, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me again, Tom.
There's this notion abroad that there's a sort of consensus among scientists that to make the full advance that people are hoping for, you've got to include embryonic stem cell research. But then there's an assertion that, no, we don't, that adult is enough. What are the politics of this, and what have you seen in your reporting about how this really breaks down, Gareth?
Well, I think that argument between adult and embryonic stem cells is really part of the political debate. It's not really a scientific debate. I think if you talk to all scientists would agree that just from a pure scientific perspective, having adult stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research is really the best way to go. There are scientists and other people who have ethical problems, of course, and they use that as an argument for not pursuing embryonic stem cell research. One of the things that I think is really critical to understand here is how science works. And I think that just even in this conversation, you've seen the scientists sort of struggling to answer where this is going to end up. Where is adult stem cell research going to end up? And where is embryonic stem cell research going to end up? And the problem is that science is not like building a bridge. It's not. It doesn't get you from point A to point B. Science is a lot more like exploring a continent that we've never been on before. And these scientists are just at different points on sort of the beach, if you will, and they're going to head inland, and nobody knows what they're going to find. And so it's very difficult to predict, you know, whether adult stem cell research is going to help with a particular disease or embryonic stem cell research is going to help with a particular disease. Science is a lot more about exploring the unknown, and sort of by its definition, you don't know where that exploration is going to end up.
And Gareth, in the minute we have left, does it matter whether the U.S. federal government funds more of this research or not? Is it going to happen anyway, whether here or elsewhere? And what about the issue of American competitiveness in these biosciences?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that the restrictions are slowing down research in this country. But I think it's also true that the research is progressing. It's going to progress around the world. And I think that the United States has continued to be a real force in this field, even with these restrictions. I think, however, there is a larger problem in science in this country. And I think it is disturbing when you sort of look out in the future and ask yourself, where is the next generation of great scientists going to come from? And that has nothing really to do with these particular restrictions, but is really a broader problem that I think a lot of people who looked at it find disturbing.
Disturbing because they fear fewer scientists? Why?
What it means is that if we lose our scientific base, that has economic consequences. It has consequences intellectually, and I think that it would be a real shame if a country that has made its name in exploring new parts of science were to lose its edge.
Gareth Cook, 2005 Pulitzer Prize winner for coverage of stem cell research at the Boston Globe. Gareth, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.